This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
I hope that everyone had a Merry Christmas. This is Spengola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spengola. I'm broadcasting from the Chicago suburbs. Thanks for joining me at republicbroadcasting.org. I know that this is a busy time of the year and lots of things to do, lots of people to see. So anyway, thanks for joining me. I hope that you will also visit and subscribe to SpengolaSpeaks.net and ScreeningSandyHook.net. And, of course, there are other websites that post our audios and take comments. And I appreciate them doing that. During the program, email questions or comments to comment@Spengola.email. Our tech wizard, who I owe a great deal to, says that if you write comments inadvertently instead of comment, he has it geared to go to the right place. Anyway, I hope that you will visit the chat room at spengola.chatango.com. View our past, current, and future guest lineup at spengola.com. You will find a schedule all the way back to October 23rd, 2010. That was the day that I began broadcasting on RBN. So if you want to see the links and see the people I've had on the program before, and kind of catch up to maybe you missed something, that you can go back and look in the archives and listen to programs that you may have missed. And we've interviewed a lot of really interesting people, and we have today a very interesting guest. His name is Christopher Fulton, and the website is cmfulton.com. He and his wife, Michelle, are the authors of The Inheritance, Poisoned Fruit of JFK's Assassination. There have been many, many books written about the assassination, and certainly this is a unique book, very, very unique. And the author has suffered, endured some very unique trials, pretty much literally, as a result of his information. And he kept it kind of quiet to himself for quite some time. And interestingly enough, of course, it was released by Tryon Day, November 22nd, 2018. Tryon Day publishes a lot of very interesting books. Anyway, Christopher, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Deanna. Appreciate you having me on.
The story is amazing. most people just accept the traditional or I should say the programmed responses. Oh yeah, Lee Harvey Oswald did it. And case closed. A lot of people believe that is what occurred. When in fact there are a few people who have questioned it and have read other books that show different circumstances and a lot of evidence. And your book indicates that there was, and I believe that there was, a political coup in 1963. Robert Kennedy had possession of some evidence, and with that evidence, he was able to prevent World War III and attempt to keep the remaining Kennedy family safe. And of course, he attempted to become president, which did not occur. And anyway, in mid-1990s, that evidence came into your hands through Evelyn Lincoln, President Kennedy's personal secretary. How did this occur?
Well, it's a long process, but basically, my friend and I were the ones that had received the bulk of the materials that came out of the White House, the Kennedy administration, that was removed following the assassination of President Kennedy. Bobby Kennedy had, and Evelyn Lincoln, who was his secretary for 12 years, were the ones basically in charge of securing that information out of the White House, and then of course, that included the Oval Office private recordings or the secret recordings and the briefing room recordings that President Kennedy put in place to secure what was actually happening in the country because he was so at odds with the generals in the Pentagon and the CIA, so he wanted to keep everybody on record.
Wow. And you acquired it. And what did you do with this information?
The Evelyn Lincoln had been left this vast amount of material that Bobby Kennedy had been working with Robert Kennedy during his time following his brother's assassination and, of course, conducting his own investigation, a private investigation, separate of that of the Warren Commission, separate of that of the Johnson administration and the FBI. So these materials were kept by him. Including the closest physical evidence to the frontal headshot that occurred in Dallas. I had possession of that physically, and that piece of evidence and other pieces of evidence in the autopsy that were kept by Robert Kennedy to prove the chain of custody and prove that his brother was taken out in a domestic coup. That information was utilized by him to contact the Russian government through back channel to allow them to understand that he was fully aware that this was a political and a domestic coup, and that the Russian government would not be held accountable in any way. And of course, the Russian government was on high alert at that time and was ready for possible exchange from the Pentagon of a missile attack. And Robert Kennedy, to his credit, did everything he could to swallow the assassination of his brother. They were at odds with their own government. They had been so for some time over many issues, one of those being primarily Cuba and the first strike on Moscow. So to Robert Kennedy's credit, he swallowed a lot of that and did not affect another coup against the Johnson administration, and subsequently conducted his own investigation of this and kept those materials secret. Following some time, he decided that he needed to run for the office of presidency in 68. That was his plan for quite some time, but he kept that to himself. He had made agreements with the Johnson administration, President Johnson himself, not to testify for the Warren Commission and keep the evidence that he had secret. Now the FBI, even the CIA and the Kennedy family themselves, the other family members, were not aware of what these materials were and how vast they were. This was all kept very quiet. Robert Kennedy was involved. Evelyn Lincoln was involved. And, of course, a Secret Service agent named Robert Bauck, who was the head of the Protective Research Section of the White House. He was involved in this. And they were all working in close communication once he reached the office of President of the United States in 1968, he would have released this and resolved these issues, but he had no power to do that until that time.
Wow. My gosh. And of course he was, taken out. This is unbelievable. Well, no, it isn't. It isn't unbelievable. Why did you wait so long to write this book?
Well, there's a lot of reasons behind that. One of them was that when we came into possession of all of this, we were reviewing this. It took quite some time. We're talking about many thousands of documents and other personal correspondence and physical materials from the assassination and everything else. It took quite some time to review a lot of this, to put this together, and we had to some direction from Evelyn Lincoln. Some of these letters were to be utilized for purpose of display for the American public, which that was the intention. Evelyn Lincoln did not want these materials to fall under the power of any government agency, the NSA, the CIA, the FBI, or the White House, or even the presidential library. She wanted to make sure that she found someone that she could trust that would keep these items and materials secured until such time that they could be brought forward to the public, and that way they wouldn't be confiscated and classified away from the existence, and the American public could understand the processes of what was actually going on.
Right. And of course, a lot of the information about the assassination, it's not supposed to be revealed for, what is it, 75 years?
Well, these things were put off for some time. The American public was given some information, or the best truth, which was put forth, which Bobby Kennedy was forced into that position to save many American lives. The war out of Vietnam was a 10-year planned war to lessen the resolve of the communist effect on Southeast Asia, and of course they wanted the real reason, one of the main reasons for this, they wanted to show the Russians that the American people, the American government, would be ruthless if necessary, and we're not weak on this. So they, you know, going in and carpet bombing civilians was something that we did to show the Russians our resolve. Now, that 10-year war really transferred a lot of money and power to the specific people that were involved, President Johnson being one of those individuals. And, of course, President Kennedy was going to stop all of that. He, on the recordings that I was the first person to listen to his Oval Office recording since Bobby Kennedy had been assassinated in 68, and this was very revealing. And on one of the recordings, he says, "I'll be the least popular president in 1964 with my own government." He was going to pull out all of the personnel out of Vietnam, including the CIA personnel, and stop that conflict. He did not believe in it and thought it was wrong. And of course, there was a lot of policies that came out of the Pentagon following World War II that had built up to his administration that he did not agree with, and he was going about 180 degrees differently. And there were plans and circumventing all of that. So really the intelligence community, the CIA specific, and the Pentagon were very much at war with the Kennedy administration for a minimum of 2 years. And this really caused a lot of problems, and both the brothers were considered national security concerns.
It is a shame, a crime, that people feel it necessary for profitable objectives to go and slaughter people in foreign countries that have never done anything to them. And of course, as you say, that was Kennedy's plan, was to pull out. And there, in my own research, into the Vietnamese situation, I read some things about Kennedy, about his feelings about that. And then when you recognize that government officials, high government officials, have the foreknowledge or create the circumstances in which they can make a lot of money by slaughtering other people.
That's right. Well, it's not only money, but power. And power, of course, the ultimate idea is how do you affect control? How do you become a superpower after World War II with the weapons of such mass destruction that they are unimaginable and only continuing to grow in strength? So President Kennedy took it upon himself, looking at this and reviewing all these statistics, looking at the first strike at Moscow, which was put across his desk in 1962. And of course, this had been reviewed and planned for quite some time. They wanted to, the idea was to hit Moscow first so that we could take out the Russian government, and then the infrastructure would fall before the missile gap got too close. And the missile gap, of course, at that time was heavily in our favor, which was not well publicized. And Cuba was the catalyst for all of this. So this was a very tentative situation. People know about the Bay of Pigs, and they know about the missile crisis. but they don't know that this was a continuing problem. During the Bay of Pigs, Mr. Dulles had promised, the CIA had promised to President Kennedy that they would take Castro out. The small landing force could operate and a popular uprising would take place in the island of Cuba, and that would be resolved. President Kennedy had given some orders to make sure that there was no planes available for any attack on those men landing on the beach. Of course, his orders were circumvented that morning, and the planes did still exist. And then, of course, Mr. Dulles was not even in Washington. He left during that operation, and they did not take Castro out, they promised to President Kennedy. And President Kennedy took responsibility for that action. He said, I'm the head of government, and, of course, it falls on me. But that period, he realized that his own people were subverting what he had to say and weren't following his orders, and that he looked foolish, and that he needed to start operating in a way that circumvented his intelligence and circumvented his own people, and used his brother that was there to protect him and protect his back. So President Kennedy started to work with people very closely that were in the diplomatic corps and the Hollywood and the press corps that he trusted with national security concerns, that he could go directly to the source and start to direct this without being circumvented by our own government system. The last thing President Kennedy wrote aboard Air Force One when he landed in Love Field was, "Government reform, we are going forward." Now, that was a coded message that he had written down to be thrown into the speech at the trademark. And that was a message that was going directly to Khrushchev's ears, that within 9 days they were going ahead with the plan to resolve the issues in Cuba. Within 9 days they would have had either a democratically elected Cuba, and that would have been resolved, or Castro would have capitulated to Kennedy's wishes, which was happening that morning. But that didn't happen. But of course the CIA, as it were, and of course the mafia connections that were utilized since World War II to win the war during that period, that would have been, President Kennedy was going to end that. There was going to be strictly a military operations from then on, and then world events and these world constructed events and these false flag operations would have ceased. And the people that were involved in a false flag operation to shoot at the President of the United States to force his position in Cuba, to invade Cuba, realized that there wasn't much time left, that they were running out of time, and very soon that his brother would have had operational control over who protected his brother, that the Secret Service would no longer have control over that, and that the CIA would be demolished.
Well, the Dulles brothers have always been very well connected with CIA and well, going back even to the Versailles Treaty. So it's unfortunate. And
yes, Dulles was certainly operating at capacity at Georgetown, even though President Kennedy had fired him over the whole falling out and replaced him. And of course, they were trying to keep the replacement on point and hoping that he was working on their behalf to weed out these people that they thought were bad apples in the CIA that were operating independently. So they were, the Kennedy brothers were, or specifically Bobby Kennedy, was going after these individuals to get rid of them. They didn't want these people circumventing their orders and causing problems that could lead us to war. And, of course, the Pentagon wanted that to happen. They wanted to initiate a first strike. Robert Kennedy looked at the statistics of this, a first strike on Moscow, and 1962 or 63 would have resulted in 42 million American civilians dead. That's a minimum count. Now, if it had gone slightly wrong or a different direction, you would look at close to 100 million American civilians dead. So both brothers decided at that point that this was the most important issue that they had to deal with in the world, and they weren't looking at just a political office at that point. They were looking at giving their lives for this endeavor so that we can continue in a free free world with our morality intact and our democracy intact. Yeah, President Kennedy, I think, believed, said that we could be the greatest generation this country's ever known, or we can be the last. And this was a very serious issue, and both men died over this issue.
Wow. All right, we are going to a quick 3-minute break. We will be right back. All righty, we are back. Our guest today is Christopher Fulton. The website is cmfulton.com. He is the author of The Inheritance, Poisoned Fruit of JFK's Assassination. His co-author is his wife, Michelle Fulton. And our friend Mark down in Florida mentioned that Senator Kennedy entered the 83rd Congress on January 3rd, 1953, and Evelyn Lincoln started work as his personal secretary at that time. So that's an interesting tidbit.
She was with him on a daily basis, probably closer to him than anybody other than his brother. But, of course, she spent every day with him in his political career and his rise coming into the White House, and was privy to just about everything. So, of course, she was terrified after the assassination, and Robert Kennedy had come to her and said, my brother had died. He just died in our efforts to prevent World War III, and the someday all of this will come out. But for now, it has to remain, for the protection of the American public, it has to remain secret. But Evelyn Lincoln was terrified. She was very scared about all of this and actually left the country for some time, as did some of the other people that were involved with President Kennedy. So, of course, some of them died. A lot of people died involved in this. They stayed, but there was several people that left the United States for a period of time. And Evelyn Lincoln only came back to the United States following a request by Robert Kennedy to help him organize and get these materials properly secured so that they wouldn't be gone forever, destroyed or taken through the FBI and the Johnson administration. So she agreed to do that. Of course, she was loyal to both Kennedy brothers to the day she died, and did exactly what she had been instructed to do. There is some really negative things have been said in the press about Evelyn Lincoln, but I can tell you that none of them are accurate.
How unfortunate. And of course, if people hear it on TV, they hear something in the news, and they just naively accept things that, without really looking into it any further. When JFK Jr. Reached out to you in 1998, tell us a little bit about that. And of course, there are other people in the Kennedy family that have been killed, I believe, including John F. Kennedy Jr.
Well, the family has paid an extremely high price for all this. There's no doubt about that. My involvement in this, my family has paid a price. I lost my mother over this. I lost my lawyer. I lost a friend. I paid a price in this as well. And of course, I lost many years of my life in federal prison for this. But the let me just say that when we received these materials, and as we were going over them, we were contacted. I was first contacted by CSIS, which is the Canadian Intelligence Service. I happened to be in British Columbia building high-rise towers at the time. And CSIS contacted me to let me know that I was what I you know some of the materials how important they were and concerning they were to the United States government, and they let me know that they had contacted their affiliate in the CIA about it. So following that, Robert White, who's my friend in this, who was the direct recipient of the majority of her materials that after the after she passed away, that came to court process, he was contacted by President Reagan, who instructed him to come to California, meet with Dam, and to discuss all of this. And when they met, the discussion was that when we reviewed these materials and finally had a handle on it, we would know more about this than the President of the United States, and that it was very important to him that this information be resolved at some point and come forward at some point and resolved as Americans, as an American problem, not to be released or come through a foreign government in any way, because it could affect the process of trust between the American people and the government of the United States, and of course the democratic process. So he was very concerned that the materials held back by Bobby Kennedy. He said, "You're going to be you both are going to be called to testify in front of the Assassination Records Review Board at some point. And then these materials that Bobby Kennedy was involved with, they're going to want to get those, classify them, and pull them in, and secure them so that the American public won't see them. So we were given a heads up about that, and following that, I thought it was best to get I had the closest physical evidence to President Kennedy's head wound that Bobby Kennedy had used to determine there was a frontal shot into his temple. And also that piece of evidence was utilized to confirm that Lyndon Johnson had given orders to his Secret Service agents and been involved in the knowledge of this beforehand. So I thought it was best to get that piece of evidence back to the Kennedy family, let them make a decision on it. So in 1996, I contacted Caroline Kennedy through Subbies, through Warren P. Whiteman, who was the vice president there. They had handled the Jackie O sale. And I discreetly contacted her. She'd come into New York there to review this and just spent about an hour reviewing it and told them that she needed to speak with her uncle Ted Kennedy about this, but gave me no direction about what to do. So I was left a little bit not knowing how to deal with that evidence particularly.
And our guest today is Christopher Fulton. His website is cmfulton.com. He is the co-author with his wife, Michelle, of The Inheritance, Poisoned Fruit of JFK's Assassination. And so you were talking about meeting or crossing paths with President Ronald Reagan, the Clintons, the Russian government, Donald Trump, U.S. Justice
right.
Department, Secret Service, the Kennedy family, and you were mentioning about Caroline. And then you were labeled a threat to U.S. national security. But continue with what you were saying right before we cut to break.
Yeah, I apologize. I might have ended just a slight bit early for you. But around the same time that I was talking about contacting Caroline Kennedy, but I'd also been called to go to Russia, to Moscow. This was in direct correlation to the business I was doing in Vancouver, British Columbia, which was the high-rise construction business. So I had taken that position over in Moscow to affect upgrading flats for oil people coming in for oil production putting money in, businessmen coming in and putting money into infrastructure coming into Russia. So as I was there, I was kind of VIP'd, and I figured, well, that's very nice. And then I was brought into the Kremlin and sat in the Politburo box to watch Swan Lake, and I thought, well, this is really amazing. I'm being VIP'd as an American business person. But then the following day, I was called into a meeting in the Kremlin to meet somebody. I assumed he wanted to just speak to me about the work that I was doing there. But this person turned out to be a man named General Alexander Levitt, who was the head of their intelligence service and their military, a general in their military, and also was a person that was running for the presidency of Russia. So as I met this gentleman, he informed me that he was aware that Robert White and myself had come into possession of the key materials from Robert Kennedy and President Kennedy's White House, the administration, that had been deep six for so many years, and then what we were going to do with it. And of course, he started briefing me on the Russian side of this, which I felt I wasn't supposed to hear. But of course, he went on to gain my trust and confidence about this, and went on to tell me many things, including the fact that the Russians were very concerned about all this when it had taken place. They thought that Robert Kennedy should have effected a coup immediately against the Johnson administration, which, of course, he did not. They effectively had gained information through Robert Kennedy and they trusted him. They trusted him to, when he told them that he was not going to pursue any possibilities or push any situations in the United States that would lead to an exchange or war. So they were very much impressed with Robert Kennedy, and they also were very interested in the truth coming out about this, because they didn't want to be blamed. They were looking at the press and what was coming out over the assassination. They didn't want to be blamed for this, and they didn't want a rogue general in the Pentagon firing off a missile. So they put a lot of pressure on the Johnson administration, and of course they informed me that the Warren Commission that was established was really more for absolving the Russian government and letting them know that they were off the hook in the world of the stage than it was about informing the American public. So I thanked him for this engagement, but of course as someone who was about to be possibly a military officer myself, I was slated to go to the Annapolis Naval Academy at one point in 1983, but I decided to not engage him on this and said thank you very much. They didn't threaten me in any way, but they did offer me to release some materials through Russia and not be censored in any way. They were very interested in this information coming forward so that they could, look kindly in the face of the American public. But I just said I wasn't interested in any of this, that I thanked him for the meeting and I left. Following that, following the fact that the Kennedy family gave me no direction specific, Robert White and I continued in the idea of writing a book to try to get this kind of slowly introduced to the American public, and then a museum. He was very interested in a museum that could be put forth, and then as people would gain interest and knowledge about this, we could kind of squeak out maybe some information that would be helpful. But both of those projects were not viewed very kindly and were being squashed down out of New York, and so subsequently one thing led to another, and then Donald Trump in 1997 had met with Robert White discussed with Robert White about opening up a auction there and utilizing his name and Trump Tower to promote these ideas coming forward and gaining more information with the press. Of course, the press corps was all over us late 97 and early 98. CNN had presented the evidence on their program, and of course, all they knew was this is something the president had warned that day. That's the only information that was released to them. Katie Couric was very interested, had the evidence on her program. This was in my possession at the time, and many others. But subsequently, those programs have been pulled. The public doesn't have access to seeing that stuff much anymore. And when the media came on board, I was asked to do interviews with everyone, and I turned them all down. I thought the Kennedy family had finally got involved. JFK Jr. had got involved and wanted this evidence for his own personal understanding of his father's assassination, and he had contacted Castro and other people to put evidence together so that he could release this at some point to the American public. So I was very encouraged by this, but the Justice Department had got involved at that time and was very, very, very concerned, and they were trying to stop the auction with an injunction. They issued subpoenas. Frank Hunger of the Department of Justice issued a subpoena for Robert White on January 9th, 1998 to testify and give information about what he had forced his hand. Both Robert White and I were declared to have national security information. This coming through the Assassination Records Review Board to the Security Oversight Office on March 3rd, 1998. Robert White was forced to sign agreements with the Kennedy family and with the Justice Department, and the FBI came in and confiscated many of the materials that he had that were directly related to the assassination or Cuba, and they were classified. And then, of course, I was arrested in August of 1998 under a sealed warrant indictment on a tax position that had occurred 6 years prior to that. I had signed a statement at Riggs Bank in Potomac, Maryland that identified my income in the United States improperly. So they utilized that along with any time that I had done anything as another count. And that all added up to about a 50-year threat that I was looking at when I was whisked away by the FBI.
Holy cow. Amazing. And you were incarcerated. For how long?
Almost definitely incarcerated. I was extradited from Canada. They did not want to discuss this with the Canadian government. So they utilized a tax indictment and seal to keep this secured. And then I had to, when I got into U.S. soil, I was placed aboard government aircraft, federal aircraft, by the U.S. Marshals, chained up to other people of intensity for the government. And we were taken up to 10,000 feet. We'd fly for 10 minutes and then we'd come down. That we'd land at either federal military bases or federal prison bases. And then we'd be back up for another 10 minutes at cruising altitude and back down. We'd come up and down all day long, starting at 5 in the morning. And then by the end of the day, we're processed. We get a few hours sleep and we're back up. We did that for about a month. Now, the reason the government does that is, go ahead.
I was just going to ask why.
Well, the government does that. They fly you all over the country and don't give you access to family or to lawyers or anything else to show you that you're now in the custody of the federal government, and you're at such of a concern that you are being cut off from your prior life and shown that you have no power, no effect. So that when you get into a position finally to talk one-on-one with the Justice Department, with the Jan Arenos people, that you have no more resolve. So I did that for about a month, and then I went to New Jersey, where I was placed into a facility that was very overcrowded. So they placed me into a military coffin, where I slept for about a month in a coffin underneath a bunk. And once I was transferred from there in an armored type transport vehicle, we went down to a place called Baltimore City Inner Jail, or the Baltimore City Jail, which is an old facility that was utilized during the slavery times for runaway slaves. And of course I slept on cobblestone there, bare cobblestone with urine and feces. That's what I slept on there, a very violent place. So then I left that facility and finally wound up in the Fourth Circuit pretrial, which is maximum security there to face what they wanted me to do. And of course what they wanted was to place 50 years upon me and get me to put the recordings, the White House recordings, into the Fourth Circuit so that they could classify those away. And then, of course, they wanted to interrogate me in secret without my rights, without counsel, in interrogations with the Justice Department and the intelligence services over the materials that we were exposed to. I rejected this and fought this for almost a year. And after that time, it got to the point where the Justice Department got frustrated. They figured they would break me in half very quickly, but I had a little bit more resolve than that. Although I was watching in this place we did not know what time it was or time of day. It was a very maximum secured facility, and I watched one person go out with a lethal injection. They killed him, and then another person his head was cracked open by people that came in with black suits and German Shepherds. Oh, I was up against the wall, and they killed him. It was a very harsh environment, and it was there to break your resolve. There were certain people there that they're there for decades, giving information to the federal government, trying to get their life sentences down so that they can go home and see their children at some point. But most of the people that were in there are looking at very severe situations. I was looking at a 50-year threat, and then they went after my family, threatening to, they sent agents down and threatening to take property away and homes away from my family and come up with anything they could to hurt me. And then I said, well, of course I'll capitulate. Let's do this. I'll come in and you can interrogate me, and I'll face the 50 years, try to get me down on that on time. But I would not hand over the recordings. That was a stipulation I would not break on. I would not give them the Oval Office recordings. So they gave me what's called a blanket immunity. A federal blanket immunity, which consisted of the fact that they would not harm me any further, nor my family, and they would protect us from any further prosecution involved in what I had to do to declare to the Justice Department, including prosecution from any foreign governments. So I went in under the guise that if I had lied or not told the truth, that the FBI would come back, and of course I'd be looking at 50 years of imprisonment. But I told the Justice Department the truth about all these matters, and they wanted to know who was uh, or was I working for the Russians? Was I working for somebody as an agenda? You know, who was involved in this? What was the agenda of this? What was the purpose of the evidence? Where was this going? So I answered the questions the best I could, and of course I had help from the federal judge who reviewed this and looked at the material and decided that this was an extreme and prejudiced situation, and reduced the sentence that I was looking at. And of course, I had a U.S. senator help me when I got out. But this whole endeavor was about 8.5 years.
Wow, amazing! And yet, when you look at the rendition programs that they've had since that time, since 1998. They can pretty much do to any citizen what they would like to do.
And well, if you cross the, I can testify to that. As I sat there with the Assistant Attorney General, these people working through General Reno's office, they were attacking people that had no blemish of any kind, upstanding citizens that have served their country and other things, saying, listen, let's just give you the statute books and we'll come up with something and we'll ruin their lives and bring them in. And I said, you've got to be kidding. This is not the America that I grew up in. And they said, well, this is what we'll do. We'll do whatever we have to gain our resolve. And so that's when I realized that this was a situation far beyond what my control of it. And I was going to have other people harmed. The experience changed me. It's changed me permanently, and I was lucky to, I felt very lucky to survive it. I feel that probably going into prison for that length of time probably saved my life. But, the experience has scarred me to the point where it took years, and I'm still trying to recover from it. So it's been a very difficult road.
Indeed. I'm kind of amazed you're still alive.
Well, there's a lot of people that were not incarcerated, that were out, that died, that were involved in this. And my mother was subpoenaed to testify. And of course, she perished from a massive stroke, the strain of this. My lawyer died in involvement in this. Robert White died shortly after, I was incarcerated.
Oh, really?
He was pounded to death. Well, he died of a massive heart attack. And my lawyer had contacted, to make a very long story short, he had been hounded to death. And of course, JFK Jr. died as well when I was in prison, which I was very saddened to hear about that.
Yes, of course. Oh, goodness. Well, I'm really glad that you wrote the book. Last week we had two gentlemen on that talked about the autopsy, and they confirm what you've been talking about. but it is
President Kennedy was assassinated by a coup. There was a false flag operations in place to shoot at the president prior to Dallas. He was doing his best to avoid those situations so that he could avoid being placed in the position where the American public would force him to go in to invade Cuba. He was trying to handle these situations in a way that would allow us to break free of these type of post-war plans that would take us down the wrong road. And of course, we have gone down the wrong road for a very long time. President Kennedy, if he had lived, would have taken us to a much different way of handling our affairs as a country. And I believe that a lot of the divisions that we have now would not exist.
Indeed, I'm sure you're right. Okay, we are going to a 3-minute break. We'll be right back. Today is is Christopher Fulton. His website is cmfulton.com. He is the co-author with his wife, Michelle, of The Inheritance, Poisoned Fruit of JFK's Assassination. It's full of interesting facts and just, it is an amazing book, and it is available and as a Kindle as well as a paperback. Anyway, thank you. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
excuse me. I know that he was assassinated, but whenever you hear so many facts put together, so much information about just how contrived everything is and just how involved top level officials are and just how much power that the government, quote unquote, has over the average citizen, it's still overwhelming to hear about it. It really is. We think that we're free. We are probably the least free country in the entire world.
Well, you're free as long as you don't pop up on the radar to cause a concern.
Right. Keep your mouth shut.
And of course,
free.
Well, I find it interesting. If I had written this book, when I was released from prison, I don't think, number one, I don't think I would have gotten it out at all. But the fact is that the country has become, as a whole, become much more understanding of the fact that we are being misinformed on a consistent basis, that's been done for purpose, that the divisions are being placed we're being guided into that channel for purpose. And I think that it's very healthy that we start as a country, as a nation, as a world, understanding of that and being aware of that and having that being a fact-based a scenario. Because I can tell you from my firsthand experience, it certainly is. When, you know, it's very difficult when you're somebody that's been placed into a situation where you're now fighting for your life and you're doing time, very close proximity with people that are that have murdered many people or have been in the extreme situations or psychotic in that way. And then I can tell you that as a moralistic individual, your mind has a hard time grasping all of that because it's not something that you would do. It's not something that you would concede to or have any interest in pursuing. But I can tell you that the evil does exist, and these psychotic type of people enjoy once they cross the line of this to murder, to kill, to gain power. This is something that does exist, and it's something that is a serious problem when those type of individuals have large amounts of money or wealth or power, because the rest of us are led to slaughter in this, and decisions that are being made, we're nothing but pawns, and we really need to take an effect of being involved in our own fate.
Indeed. Alrighty, we are at the top of the hour. We will be right back with our wonderful guest, Christopher Fulton. Be right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Christopher. Christopher Fulton. He is the co-author, along with his wife Michelle, of The Inheritance, Poisoned Fruit of JFK's Assassination. It came out on November 22nd, 2018, and it was published by Trine Day. You brought up and the website is cmfulton.com. You brought up a very interesting point, right before the top of the hour break. You said that most people who are just, God-fearing, honest people who would not conceive of murdering or harming or doing anything evil or harmful in any way to anyone just cannot conceive of there being a large amount of people who are psychotic and who have stabbed people in the back figuratively to get to where they're at, and they use their money and their psychotic behavior to make more money. And but I do think that the internet has been a boon. It can also be a negative. I think that people need to be very careful of what they post. It can be misinterpreted. And I think that people who post their entire daily life on Facebook and other places are just very foolish, incredibly foolish. Okay, that's my little rant. You've suffered a great deal. The people that you were close to have suffered, and certainly with your mother's passing, and it was obviously stress related. Oh gosh.
Well, it's hard to, and you don't want to. I mean, if you were in war, or you were in the situations that life can put you in, unfortunately, sometimes you go through things that, for my example, I watch people hang themselves, because they couldn't deal with the fact that they're going to die in prison, that they're going to get a life sentence, and they never see their children, their families again. And of course I woke up many times where I was broke and I thought I wanted to die too. But sure. You don't want to instill that. You don't want to instill that to other people. You don't want to put them through that kind of extreme situation. And so you try as a good person, you try to absolve people of that. In the book, I thought it was important to take the reader through a step by step what had happened to me, so that they could kind of walk in the same shoes and then kind of look through their own filters and decide what they could take from that, or what might be important to them, or what have you. But I thought, I couldn't dishonor the people that have died through this, even my own family, and of course the President Kennedy and Senator Kennedy and many other good people that have died in wars and other things that were so unnecessary, and I couldn't dishonor all of that by not writing this down. For years I wanted to forget everything. I was sorry that I'd been exposed, and of course the federal government was very, very angry that I was exposed to this, and who was I to make any choices involved in the national security issues of the United States and all these things. But I could not, in my conscience, a good conscience, leave it to my children or pass from this world without at least sharing what had taken place to help the country maybe better understand and to maybe heal a little bit from this. I thought that it would be a very selfish and an unfair act if I didn't step forward at some point and do this. And then, of course, I was really hoping that the records that came out through President Trump that pushed to the National Archive, my name appears in that investigation through the Assassination Records Review Board. I thought, well, maybe possibly the information might come out through that, but of course it did not. I took it upon myself to have somebody go to the College Park and do a 30-day investigation physically at the National Archives to see if the information could come out. And of course, one of the major file folders that is involved with this situation has been removed. The The National Archives recognizes the fact that it's supposed to be there and understands that it's there, but it's missing, and there's been no pull slip for it from any agency or president, so it's just gone.
Wow. Well, the one thing I like about your book is that about one-fifth of the book is images, documents, and photographs, and people can see for themselves, and I'm sure that there were, as you said in the beginning of the program, thousands upon thousands of pages
thousands
of documents.
There's thousands. Anyone who's been through a federal case, William, people say don't make a federal case out of it. There's boxes of folders involved in a federal case. I submitted some materials that I had to the publisher, and then, of course, he, in his generosity, took it upon himself to take some of those and put them in the book so they print them out so that people could see some of the Justice Department's case file on this. And then one of the things I thought was good to put in there was their subpoena power, I showed the subpoena that came in for these records, and also the initial write-ups for these subpoenas, their beginning drafts of these things, so you could get a good handle on what they were concerned about and what they were looking for. And the lengths that they were going to go to make sure that we fell under their yoke of resolve and put through the process one way or the other. Of course, Sir Robert White died and I went to prison. They got what they wanted from both of us one way or the other. And they classified that away from the American public. But I can at least tell the story as it went along and share with the American public what I have to share, and hopefully you can gain something from that.
It just seems that in order to get elected and stay as an official, that you have to go along to get along. And if you don't...
Well, my grandfather used to say that you can't go into an honest... game of cards and everyone else is cheating. You can't play an honest game. So that's the way things have been rigged for quite a long time.
Right. And they've been using these same tactics for quite some time. They killed Schmedley Butler because he was going to say war, you know, he wrote the book War is a Racket. Well, they've killed a number of people who had things to say, or they simply get somebody else elected, such as Finley here in Illinois. They just paid somebody else and supported somebody else so that you can get rid of people that won't go along with the agenda. And so
if you're a good person, and you've got a strong moral base and you've got family that you love and people you care about, you know, why would you subject yourself to a pit of vipers? Why would you do that? It's a very difficult thing to do. And then, of course, you're forced into positions where you have to make hard decisions and go along with the consensus sometimes with decisions that cost people's lives that you don't agree with. And so this is a very difficult job to do and in a way when you're not you're very much a minority. So why? More and more is the fact of why would good people take these positions? Why would they even try to push that agenda?
Yes. And they all say they're going to go out there and change Washington, and nobody ever really does. And there's so many crooked politicians, and they know about the foibles of these politicians so that they can expose them at any time. That they don't go along with the agenda. It was during the funeral and all of the nonsense that was happening right after George H.W. Bush died. It was pretty sickening, considering all of the people that died, that were slaughtered, the countries that were destroyed. The infrastructure of almost the entire Middle East was destroyed. And here they were saying what a good and great man he was. It just made me sick.
President Kennedy on his recording recordings that I've listened to, was a very constitutional-based president, thought every American life was extremely important. He was willing to sacrifice his life for any one of us.
And he did.
He thought that, well, that's right. And that's the job. And that's what he took upon himself and took it very, very seriously. And so did his brother. His brother, was a very, wealthy individual and had power and had signed agreements, and after the assassination was very comfortable in the fact of, you know, being a U.S. senator and was slated to stay there. But he took it upon himself in 1968 to say, no, I'm not going to dishonor my brother. I'm not going to dishonor his death. I'm not going to allow us to continue to slaughter people in Vietnam and lose people in Vietnam. We're on the wrong course in this country. We have problems with our education. We have problems with divisions in this country between poor, wealthy and poor people, and also racial problems. And these things need to be addressed. And he made, if you go back and listen to the words that he was saying when he was running for election, these were words that were coming from the heart. These aren't, you know, he was saying that in 1968, this election is going to change the course of the world, the moral right to the world for decades and decades to come. This is a fight for the, for morality of the whole planet. And this is not a joke. This is not a simple election for some town council. This is a serious issue. And he was very much aware that he probably would not make this. You know, imagine telling your wife, I'm doing this for the betterment of the world and for the country. I might not make it. And the last thing he said in California when he was shot was, is everybody okay? Is everybody all right?
Oh.
You know, this is a person who cared about people. He cared about people. He didn't care about the money involved. He didn't care about power involved. He cared about the American people and the people of the world. And these are the type of individuals that we need in power. These are the kind of individuals that we need as parents doing what we can't do because we're busy taking care of our families at home or worried about our own issues. We need people that are there representing us that are someone that we would trust with our own family's lives if it came down to, because it's exactly what it comes down to. And, once that trust has been dissolved and you don't have a good relationship any further, where are we? We're lost. We're on a ship, kind of lost. And then, you know, right now I know we have severe divisions, over, many issues that should have been resolved a long time ago in this country, and they've just gotten farther and farther away from that purpose. And the people that benefit, you have to remember, the people that are benefiting from those issues that don't help the American public are the ones that are getting rich off of it and are doing well. It's not the American public that's doing well. We all realize instinctively, no matter what side of the fence that you fall on, that there's something very wrong. And nobody's really happy, are they? But if you're on one side or the other, they both feel strong divisions and very much unhappy. And this boat that we're all in, it's not going anywhere. We're all pulling in so many different directions, and we're all in the same boat. We're all on the same planet. We all love our children the same way. We all breathe the same air, as President Kennedy had said. And this is very important issues. I did time with a priest that had come into a maximum security prison by demonstrating against nuke weapons at a military base. The two nuns and a priest that came in for 6 months, which is the minimum you can get in the federal system.
Oh my gosh!
So I did the time with this Catholic priest. I did time with this Catholic priest. I said, Father, I'm so sorry that they put you in such a place as this. And he said, Son, don't worry about that. This is exactly where I should be. This is where I'm needed, because there's nothing more important in this world, in my mind, than to educate the American public as to the concern of these nuke weapons and the mass destruction that's taking place. And then, of course, I'm in here with you men that are fighting for your lives, that are coming forward to talk to me, open and free, to discuss the Word of God, and you have more in line with Jesus Christ than the people that are on the outside, because you're really coming under persecution and prosecution to talk about this. These are the kind of men, these are the kind of men and women, the strength of Americans that I'm proud of, the people that I associate this country with. It's that kind of endeavors of character, and that I think that we need that kind of leadership. And we've gone, like I said, over the decades, we've fallen and accepted far less than that, that for so long we don't even recognize it anymore. And we need to quickly take hold of this, or it's going to take hold of us.
I think it has. I was in an anti-war demonstration in downtown Chicago several years ago, and there were many, many buses of people that came in to demonstrate against the war in the Middle East. And oddly enough, what we saw later on the news were just the people who were pro-war. The news did not cover all of the thousands of demonstrators. And there were thousands, absolutely thousands of demonstrators. And they were ready with big buses, barred buses, to take anybody that got out of hand away. And it's amazing. So it's the way things are covered.
That's right. Mainstream media is a very, very, very important social understanding of the world. It's how people understand the rest of the world of their small communities. And so that was understood a long time ago. And the people, the men and women who control that has shrunk to a very small number, a handful of individuals that control the mass media. And of course, the CIA had planned a lot of this, and in 1947, it continued on for disinformation and the control of personnel and all the media outlets. So that the information that comes in is very much controlled and very much in line with the agenda, which is global control by corporations, by corporate agreement. Is how they try to keep us out of a nuke exchange. It's controlled by cooperation of large amounts of money and large amounts of globalism. And that's what the world is becoming more and more of. And of course, the rest of us are losing our rights and losing our abilities to act independently and to start small business and all this thing. And we're being weeded out.
Right.
And President Kennedy, very much against that, very much against that, wanted even to the fact where foreign governments, as long as they could operate on their own, and we would just support their democratic processes, but he thought it very important to let them be independent and free.
Of course.
We want to be independent and free. We don't go in and affect our policies by acts of war or weapons of mass destruction, because that's not sustainable. And these are the words that President Kennedy said. These are things that he understood very clearly back in 62 and 63, and part of the reason why they killed him.
Right. Now, his father was very much in agreement with those policies and had been for quite some time. And of course, the media smeared the Kennedys as womanizers and just about anything they could think of in order to make them look bad. This monopolization of the media occurred under somebody you've already mentioned, is Ronald Reagan, when he was president.
I'd like to address the womanizing part of it.
Yes,
I mean, that certainly have gotten way out of hand, but from what I've seen, President Kennedy was utilizing women specifically because they were able to gather intelligence and were told things that didn't come to men. And he was working with several women to help gain control of Cold War and end the Cold War. Some of these women were killed after President Kennedy was murdered, or even before he was murdered, because the powers that be did not like these outsiders being utilized for purpose. That was against the rules. But President Kennedy was very much in line with that, and what he had set up was actually working.
Wow. Alrighty, we're going to take a quick 3-minute break. We will be right back. Our guest is Christopher Fulton. The website is cmfulton.com. And please pick up where you left off about the clever use of people who could gain information. It wasn't what it has been portrayed as.
Well, it certainly was not. I mean, there were people in the media, there was people in the press corps, or in the diplomatic corps rather, and there was people in the Hollywood sector. But these were people that President Kennedy knew over long periods of time and had come to trust. So it wasn't a, it wasn't something that he took very lightly, but of course he utilized these private meetings and these get-togethers in a way that helped him secure contact with the people directly, world leaders involved, and so he could go to the source of problems rather than try to resolve it in a way that where people weren't interested in resolving these issues. So he again utilized whatever he could in secret to make a better planet for all of us, a more peaceful situation for all of us, because he realized that the people that he was working with, General LeMay and people like Mr. Dulles with the CIA, these people were insane lunatics in his opinion.
They were
insane lunatics, drunk with power, insane with it. And wanted to had a death wish for the world. And President Kennedy thought, my God, President Kennedy understood war. He'd been in World War II. He was being groomed for the presidency after his brother died. He was a naval intelligence officer. He went to Berlin. He was in the bunker after the collapse there. He saw how the Russians had acted when they came into Berlin, and he understood the American side was very concerned about the Russians, but he did not come out of the old thinking from these older gentlemen that had decided how these things were going to take place. Eisenhower went to D-Day, was very concerned about D-Day, and had written a speech or a letter rather to if the thing had failed, and it took upon himself, was very concerned about our men or our boys over there and the loss of life it was going to take to invade. But I understood that President Eisenhower had found God on D-Day and then was very, very concerned about World War III looming just around the corner. So he had made a promise, President Kennedy had made a promise to President Eisenhower that he would do whatever he had to stop that World War III from happening, and that was something he took very serious.
We probably have a different opinion about Eisenhower, but I can't say whether he found God or not, but he certainly found somebody over there that spent a great deal of time with him, and he was pretty much on board with 200 encampments, but that's another story altogether, another subject altogether. But when you think about the people that have died mysteriously, or like JFK Jr. and his wife on a plane, he was a very skilled pilot. Marilyn Monroe, her death is incredibly, incredibly suspicious. There are a lot of suspicious things going on. Correct?
If you look at the rationale of it, President Kennedy was murdered very publicly for purpose, and
it was a public
brother,
assassination.
Yes, that's right, and his brother was strong enough to step out of that shadow and to say, listen, I'm basically the head of the family now, and I'm taking responsibility to continue the policies of my brother to set the country back on course, because it's so very, very, I mean, you could clearly see, from 1964 forward to 68, how far we had just gone down the wrong road. $575 billion of money allocated to the wrong people, all the service, 2.6 service personnel sent to Vietnam, rotated around that, and all the things that were being done for the wrong purposes. But of course, he was murdered, and and so was Martin Luther King. It's very obvious. These are not acts of random mistakes. These are these are very purposeful assassinations, and they and they've taken us down a road and down a course that is really turned out to be a very bad road, and we are the results, we're experiencing those results now. But in my opinion, from what I've experienced from behind the scenes, I can only see that it could get very, very worse. And the Americans I don't believe most of the Americans realize how bad it could actually become.
Even on a personal level, you're talking about the people who, I don't want to say served, but who spent time in the military in Vietnam, where, what was it, 58,000 of them perished, and so many of them. Well, people are not made or created to kill each other. Normal individuals have an aversion to killing other human beings. And so, many people suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. And, in fact,
it's a terrible thing. It's a terrible thing. I mean, there's servicemen that kill themselves every day because they can't deal with what they've experienced or what they've been part of. And they don't have a way to relate that to people on a normal day basis. And it's tragic. It's a tragedy. You know, this is something that I deal with on a daily basis as well. And I understand how it works. And it's a very sad thing that we have to be in this boat at all.
Right. Right. Okay. We will be right back. I think it's 22 military people a day kill themselves. I'm not sure what it is, but quite a high figure. We'll be right back in 3 minutes. Our guest today is Christopher Fulton. The website is cmfulton.com. He is the co-author, along with his wife, Michelle, of The Inheritance, Poisoned Fruit of JFK's Assassination. Somebody Skyped me about an individual that Mary Pinchot Meyer. She was the wife of CIA agent Cord Meyer. And she knew Jack Kennedy when she was at Vassar. And she filed a divorce against Cord Meyer in 1958. And she knew what kind of a situation that Kennedy was involved with. And she said that he was learning too much and he was murdered, and it was because of what he was doing or attempting to do. And anyway.
That's right. That's right. And so was she.
Yes, she was murdered. When was
that's
she?
Right.
In 1960?
I believe it was 64, but I don't know exactly.
Okay, October 12th, 1964. She was murdered by a professional hitman. And she had kept a diary that was never found. And they never solved her murder. Which is...
Well, the people involved in these, think tanks and the proposals that come through the Pentagon, and this is not something that they share with the American public because they feel the American public can't handle that kind of information. For example, I was looking at documentation that was prepared through the Central Intelligence Agency that it was the acceptable losses and the each American city of American dead would be acceptable. So I'm reading that and I'm looking at this and I'm saying, well, you know, in my opinion, there is no acceptable losses. I understand that you think that this is a way to deal with any kind of plans and ways to prepare yourselves for any kind of eventualities. But at the same time, I, as a person that's moralistic, I don't I think you should be thinking about how many people you can kill to enact this problem or solve this situation. And I think that kind of thinking is very wrong. And so they don't want the American people to see that kind of intel because they don't think that they can handle it well, or they think that the fourth would be an uprising that would stop that sort of planning and thinking. And of course, I believe that that's exactly true. I think if the divisions that we have in this country right now, that weakens us. It not only weakens us as a world position, but it weakens us domestically. And of course, we don't have any power when that happens, when there's all that infighting and division. And as a country that can come together and be unified and be strong in our moral objectives and who we are as a nation and who we are as Americans, that's a scary thing because that can put pressure back on these people to circumvent their whole ideas and plans of things. I really feel that this whole secrecy, this national security ticket has been overplayed. I think it's been used to hide the massive agendas of money and power that transfer to individuals for purpose. And I think that a lot of this has to stop. And of course, that's dangerous talk because there's a lot of money and power involved in this. But the American public needs to inform themselves. The more that they can get informed, President Kennedy said that I believe in the American people when they have, they'll make the right decisions when they're well informed. And that's what he said, and I agree with that.
Right. Right. I can't imagine, well, just driving around, I live in the Chicago suburbs, and just driving around, you see so many big shopping centers closed, and so many stores are closing. The streets are in bad shape. There's big potholes, and we have bridges that are falling apart. The infrastructure is falling apart, and people should, they're not aware, they don't seem to be aware or take.
The infrastructure of the United States is breaking down.
Right.
I can give you 1,000 different examples, but if you go in to buy a part for your car, you may get a part that most times that doesn't work, and you might replace it 4 times with a part that's defective or doesn't work. These are brand new parts. That's just one example. You go into a state-run agency and you fill out a form that says, this is my statement of fact or my sworn statement to a state agency, and they look, well, this won't work. Let's just change this around. And they scribble on your state-prepared form and change it and alter it to go through the system. Now, this is the kind of things that I witnessed in Russia because the system was so disorganized and you had the ultra-rich running everything and yet everybody else running scared. And that's more and more every day. That's kind of where we're headed towards. And we need to be very, very concerned about that. Very concerned.
People are very busy doing their cell phones and their gadgets that they don't seem to be looking at what is occurring right around them. And it's so obvious. Why don't they ask? Well, how come we're spending all of this money bombing the Middle East when our country's falling apart? I don't hear people asking that question. When bridges are falling apart, production has gone offshore. It's incredible to me.
Other parts of the world are very concerned about their infrastructure and their people, but I agree with you, and of course the educational system is a tremendous concern because you know, as you infiltrate the youth as it becomes, so if you have them looking at the computer screens all day or cell phones all day or thinking that you know, they have to follow these people around and lost in this confusion, now you've got people that there are other confusers leading thousands of other confusers as sheep. So as this continues and this youth identifies with this and this is all they know, they're not looking at national issues, they're not looking at national concern, they're not looking at the broader perspective of this. And so you're losing the ability to function on a higher level as a country, and pretty much you're going to get a bunch of people just doing whatever they're told to do. And of course, that's a lot of what I experienced when I was in Russia.
The other thing, too, is that people are doing, good people are making some incredibly bad choices based on emotional appeal that they should be reconsidering the consequences. They should be thinking, okay, is this a communist kind of an objective? They're voting or embracing socialistic, communistic ideas without thinking about the consequences, simply because they were given an emotional appeal to do something. Even with,
I think the youth of this country likes the idea of socialism, or likes the idea of these types of concepts, because that's what they're being weaned on. So
sure.
I can understand that, and they don't have enough time on the planet or understanding of what the differences really are between a democracy and what differences make and how you have to preserve a democracy and what it means. So that's what I'm trying to say. There's and I hate to use the word dumbing down, but that our country is definitely dumbing down. If you look at a newsreel, when I was a young man or something of that nature, and I'm looking at somebody who maybe is 25, 28 years old, they're polished, they're professional, they're well-spoken, they're well-dressed, and they understand the issues, and they can speak with clarity. And this is someone who's young. Now we've got people in their 40s and 50s and 60s acting like children, screaming at each other to get their points across or wanting to fist fight each other over these issues. It really is an embarrassment. Not only that, but it's a national security concern. It would have been a national security concern many years ago, because you're having the rest of the world look at us as ridiculous and it's foolish behavior. So I believe strongly that our educational system needs to be totally revamped and changed, and how we approach many subjects in this country needs to be addressed and totally reformed.
Right. And the other thing that is noticeable to me is that the security here, for instance, if you go to the airport, you have to go through these radiation machines, and you have to take off your shoes, and you can't take a bottle of water, and you can't do this, and you have to, it's almost like being strip searched going through.
That's the catapult. You know, rich people don't deal with that. People that have their own aircraft or have chartered jets, sure, they don't deal with those situations. You know, when I was a young man, a kid, you walked on a plane. You had to respect that you were a grown up, that you were innocent until proven guilty. You had a decency of understanding, and you just walked out to an aircraft and got on board an aircraft. Now, I do understand that there are things that are different today than there were 40, 50 years ago, but at the same time, if you take away our decency as human beings, you strip away our ability for individual rights and all these types of things, and you've lost those things in the process, what are we fighting for? What do we have left we're holding on to? Because you've already lost the war.
And it's being done incrementally. Now, in 2007, and I've mentioned this on the program before, when I visited China, you could get on an airplane. All you had to do was hardly anything. You could take water. You didn't have to take off your shoes. You just went out and you got on the plane. And that is supposed to be, you know, a very strict society. It is a strict society, in many respects. But as far as airplane security, it really was very insignificant and mild compared to what it is here.
Everything has an infrastructure, and it has that infrastructure has cost, and people make money with that infrastructure. Those are things like you mentioned in this conversation very early, that the people make their own agendas and their own problems, and then they have create this infrastructure that makes a lot of money for individuals and corporations that in my opinion isn't proven to stop anything. So in all many aspects of American life, these infrastructures have been put into place for making large amounts of money. And
right.
it's not beneficial. It's not a wise way to handle our taxpayers' money. In my personal opinion, there's a lot of other more important issues and other things that we can address. And of course, if the only thing we can figure out is to put ourselves in handcuffs, so that we don't hurt ourselves as adults, then I think we've lost the whole big picture.
Right. Now there have been so many books written about JFK. Why is your book different from the others? I mean, I think it's different. It's very different. But
let me get a drink of water here.
Sure. Of course, you had information available to you that other people simply speculated on. I love the book Final Judgment by Mike Piper, and I've read other books about JFK. And of course you have totally different information from a totally different source. I guess I can answer my own question here. The reason you're...
Well, you could, but So I appreciate you covering for me there, but let me answer the, we were in possession of documented evidence that proved the conspiracy in the 35th president of the United States. We also had evidence that showed that Bobby Kennedy was made complicit in the cover-up to preserve world peace. This information was going to go public possibly in 1998, 1999, and of course there was a battle that ensued, and that didn't happen. So the government really doesn't really care if you have a theory, or doesn't even really care if you have what we had. But what they do care about is if you have evidence that could be put tendered into federal court and then could be utilized to change official positions. And that's what we had and what we were in possession of. And that's what made us such a concern for national security and why the resolve was what it was, why we all lost in this way, because they are not interested. The Justice Department has been put in charge, fully in charge of the whole Kennedy assassination matter. And their interest is not to, they have no interest in pursuing any truth in the matter. They have no interest in because there's going to be no prosecutions or persecutions at the end of the day for them. So their directive is simply to confiscate evidence and then secure that evidence if it needs to be classified for the purpose of the American government. That's it, bottom line. Most of the evidence that's in the National Archives, or most of it that has to do with actually showing the real information has been removed or destroyed. Some of the evidence that's left that President Trump could not get out in the 11th hour, that the CIA and FBI restricted him from doing so, is evidence that involves the IRS. That's evidence that shows who is being paid by these agencies for covert operations, and that would include Oswald. And they don't want that seen. The other thing is grand jury testimony, which is sealed, which is like my testimony or other testimony that was in front of a grand jury. And the last bit of that would be any evidence that Bobby Kennedy had held back from his agreements that was made with the Johnson administration, the FBI, and the materials that we had were very covertly fell outside of those deeds of gift that Robert Kennedy and the Kennedy family was forced into in 1964-65 to sign with the General Services, to sign with the Johnson and the people of the FBI and all that, to turn over any evidence involved directly with the president's assassination and the involvement in Cuba so that it could be classified or destroyed. Robert Kennedy did his utmost to keep back some of that information, to keep his power, to keep himself secured, and to keep his family secured. Once he was assassinated in 68, it all went dark. He didn't want to pursue that any further.
Wow. Okay, we'll be right back in 3 minutes. Welcome back. This is Deanna. And our guest today is Christopher Fulton, website is cmfulton.com. He is the author, along with his wife, Jill, of The Inheritance, Poison Fruit of JFK's Assassination. Now, you mentioned Clinton in 1998, Clinton. What role, the Clintons, as far as I know, have killed so many people, it's just, they have quite a lengthy list. I can't believe they get away with this stuff, but they do. But you also mentioned that you'd crossed paths with Donald Trump, and we are going to our top of the hour break, but I wonder if you would tell us what your opinion of Trump is.
Well, I think he's he is a Washington outsider, and of course he's a New York business person that has done very well, but I think that the powers that be in Washington are worried about him because they can't predict what he's going to do. We can't, they're having a hard time controlling him. So I think he's a concern, and I think, one of the big things that I see is that he's having a hard time in his diplomacy. So that you have half the country not being at least addressed about those issues, that they can feel somewhat satisfied or be part of the process. I feel it's very important that Mr. Trump address the nation in a way that might be better than the tweets, that he would maybe gain some access to some press corps that he would trust, and then address the nation that way, which is a more standard practice. But he really needs to be as transparent as possible with the American public. But I think he has the potential of doing some great work. And I think he's got a big job ahead of him. I do think that he had conferred with JFK Jr. because some of the things that JFK Jr. and I had discussed that he put it into implement, which was the fact that he has his own private security force. He doesn't trust just the Secret Service, the agency to protect him. And he carries a gun personally. So I think that's a very wise thing that he is doing.
Well, he should go to Dallas, right?
Well, there are anytime a president is at odds with the establishment and a lot of power and a lot of money that's in place in that situation, you have to take certain precautions as much as you can, because the power and money is what makes the world go round to these people. And so but I think he has the potential for doing some great things, but I don't envy his position. I think he's got a very hard job.
Yes, certainly he does. Anybody that goes against the establishment is going to have a tough job. Now, under the Clinton administration, so many things, federal laws were changed that eased the way to warfare. And of course, the Bush family and the Clinton family worked very cohesively together to implement some of the things that economically disadvantaged other countries. Okay, we are at the top of the hour. We will be right back, and we will take calls in the next hour. Be right back.
Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back. This is Deanna, And our guest today is Christopher Fulton. His website is cmfulton.com. He and his wife, Michelle, co-wrote The Inheritance, Poison Fruit of JFK's Assassination. It was published on November 22nd, 2018. It is available. I hate to push Amazon.
Well, they can get it through our website. They can get it through our website, cmfulton.com. And if you do that, we not only endorse the book to them and sign, both of us sign something personal, but it also gives us the opportunity to give to some charities that we believe in. If you don't mind, can I say something about that real quick?
Please.
Well, Marley's Mutt's positive change program is here in California. That's run by our friend Zach Scow, and he basically takes rescues animals puts them in contact with people that are incarcerated so that they can both benefit from all of that. I think that's a very that's been an incredibly positive thing, and we're very supportive of that. Then the PTSD Foundation of America, of course, we brought that up earlier, that helps our soldiers that have been overseas and helps other people to overcome some mental stresses that are way beyond the norm. And then Ronald McDonald House, which helps people that have premature children when they don't know what to do, and gives them a place to stay right near the hospital while their child is coming back to normal weight and so forth. That's very important to us. And of course, the John F. Kennedy Library, which we are also donating to. So if you're able to buy through us, through our website that way directly, it helps us be able to help fund those charities.
Wonderful. Excuse me. We do have a caller, John in Texas.
Oh, sir. Have you found out anything about his space policies or what he planned for in the future concerning space exploration? Or what he planned to do possibly to reveal concerning what we already knew about space or what all we're already doing, and how much was he being informed of that, or was he going to spill the beans about some things, or what do you know?
One of the things I remember reviewing was the President Kennedy was very much interested in NASA joining forces with the Russians have a joint program for rocketry, which would enable us to go to the moon and do other things. And this joint program, in President Kennedy's view, was critical because it would limit the ability or the incentive for the competition against one another would be working together and lessen the chance of a accidental missile strike that would be launched that would take us to war. I did not see much information beyond that. I don't know. I knew that President Kennedy thought that the space exploration or getting to the moon was an important endeavor, and of course he was utilizing that endeavor in his opinion was going to be to keep us as a more peaceful coexisting planet rather than to take us to a possibility of war.
John,
someone had suggested that Marilyn Monroe was met by her untimely death because she was going to divulged some things concerning what they knew of, some very highly top secret stuff that Kennedy had told her during some pillow talk.
Well, she was definitely given some information. She actually had a code name in Russia that was being utilized for purpose to try to end the Cold War as early as possible. So when you get to someone like Khrushchev or these people, and Marilyn Monroe's a big deal, so they'd much rather have a talk with Marilyn Monroe than they would just about anybody else. So the idea to be able to utilize that as an asset to the American government to stop our Cold War. President Kennedy was certainly utilizing that purpose.
Did you ever find out anything about he was trying to create NASA? Why did he commit us to putting a man on the moon before the end of the decade?
The significance of that, particularly, I don't recall seeing anything that talked about that and why that he thought that was so important. But I would assume that it probably had to do with the contracts and what was happening with NASA. My father had actually worked with NASA as a contractor for he put in the concrete for those Apollo shots. But I didn't see anything specific much farther than the cooperation that he wanted with NASA and the Russian government. I didn't see anything much farther than that. So I'm sorry I couldn't answer that better for you.
I think he was more concerned about what was going on the Earth and wanted people to get along. It's like a flock of birds. They all fly together, and there's no leader. They all turn at the same time, or a school of fish. They work together, and there's no leader. They just work together and are communicating in some other way. And I think that's how humans are supposed to be, not out to get one another and slaughter each other. So thank you, John, for your phone call. If you have any questions out there, 800-313-9443. Okay, let's see. John F. Kennedy, I can't remember when he died. John F. Kennedy Jr.
It was in 1999. I believe it was July, but I'm not sure.
Okay. So, gosh, almost 20 years ago.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I totally believe that that he was murdered. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I've been very heartily advised not to indulge in this question too far, but I can tell you that in 1998, I was very happy to think that we were going to have some changes occur in the United States, and it would be coming from the son of President Kennedy. And of course, if he had done that, he would not be censored, he would not be questioned, there wouldn't be divisions about it. It would just be a change in the effect of truth and a change in the effect of this country and how we conduct ourselves. And I think that platform would have been a shock, but at the same time, it would have healed some division of this, and we'd have a solid platform to move forward. And I think it would have been very beneficial, but of course, that didn't happen, and I felt very saddened by his loss when I was sitting in prison when I heard about it.
Right. Yes. Now, Katie Couric, you mentioned Katie Couric, had some. She announced. Something about the murder and about the papers and the phone recordings that they existed, and you mentioned that those disappeared, that the program that she did regarding that just totally disappeared from
The media coverage. I mean, CNN had gotten in very close in New York when I was there, and tried to get some very close up information of the piece of physical evidence that was close to President Kennedy's frontal head wound. But of course, that was not discussed with the press. So the only thing the press that knew at that time, the only thing that was released to them is that he'd worn that the day that he died. that material, they did not know that he was not supposed to have that, that it was a, left at Parkland Hospital, that Bobby Kennedy had sent an agent specifically to get that for his own investigation. He kept it away from the FBI. It approved a frontal round to the Wright Temple. None of that was discussed. But the information, the very fact that they had honed on the fact that it was something that the public did not know about, that he had warned that day to the specific, those pieces of media information after New York was all removed from the public viewing. You can't see that anymore. It's not cataloged anywhere.
Interesting. All righty. We do have a caller, Art, in Philadelphia. Art, welcome.
Hello. I had a question. Yes. This is related to how they covered up the JFK assassination. What is the role of U.S. Senator Richard Schweiker in covering up the JFK assassination? The reason being, he was a close friend with Walter Annenberg, and the two of them were very closely associated with Richard Sprague and Arliss Specter. And Walter Annenberg's father worked for Al Capone to set up the National Crime Syndicate. And you go to the Nixon Library in Brea, Yorba Linda, and you'll see two characters there. First of all, you see the Walter Annenberg estate just to the right when you go into the Nixon Library. Then on the plaque, you see Max Fisher, who was powerful enough to start, you know, implement the Bay of Pigs affair because he was close friends with Meyer Lansky and powerful enough to influence Eisenhower. And the real purpose was to restore ownership of the Chicago asset casinos back in Havana. And I think that that tripped us almost into a nuclear war. But I see that Richard Schweiker, U.S. Senator, played a big role in how this whole thing played out. And I just wonder if you've done any analysis on that.
Well, I'll answer that as a maybe an overview. It might be better to do that. There was Cuba, of course, was a big major concern for the United States government, and of course you were mentioning about the mob concerns. That was they were utilized through the intelligence community at the same time, and they wanted their casinos back, and Castro didn't want to give those casinos back. But there was a lot of interest about the separation of missile gap, and that's why the missiles were sent over to Cuba to lessen that missile gap, and then to Russia to gain advantage. Anyway, Cuba was a big catalyst for this whole endeavor and this whole problem. But the cover up, to answer your question more specifically, the cover up of this occurred because because of Castro and some of the things that he had said in the press. There was a intelligence operation it put in place to shoot at the President of the United States, and not to kill him, but to show a public, and this is important, a public display of an assassination tied to Cuba, so that the President would be forced under American sentiment at that time to invade, which would take us to war consequently with Russia. So the President Kennedy was doing everything he could to avoid that, and was aware that he was that existed. Bobby Kennedy, his brother, was doing everything he could to protect him in this. Now, when they went to Dallas, the information that Bobby Kennedy had received that the possible shooting at the president had been in place was called off, and it was called off. But at the last minute, the plan was changed, and of course Lyndon Johnson was in on this as well, and they turned into a situation where a covert operation, a false flag operation as it will, turned into the assassination of the 35th president. Now, the American government didn't want any of that information out. They had information planted there that showed Cuba's involvement and Russia's involvement. So, when Bobby Kennedy was looking at this, if he had gone public with what he knew about it, the Johnson administration and the American government would have gone to war. Bobby Kennedy couldn't risk that. He had to go along, and so did a lot of other people involved in all of this for their own power and forwarding the motion of their careers. So they all went ahead with this and said, "Well, we'll just whitewash this and have a lone assassin being Lee Harvey Oswald." Now, Lee Harvey Oswald, of course, had touched a lot of factions of this, but he was not involved, as he said, in the Warren Commission. The Warren Commission is a fabrication on many aspects. So there was a lot of good people, good and bad, that went along with the official story of the assassination of the president, including Bobby Kennedy for purposes of maintaining the stability of the world. And, you know, there's some people that have done it for their own purpose and their own gain. And then in that regard, that was a very evil act. But in Bobby Kennedy's regard, it was very extremely the ultimate noble gesture that he took to salvation of his our position and world.
Didn't they change the route at the last minute to go past the depository?
There were things altered for a purpose, and then President Kennedy was notified that if you don't, his people were told, if you don't subject yourself to whatever we have to say in Texas, how this is going to go, then we don't even want you here. So President Kennedy needed to go down there to unify his positions at the 64 election. There was, you know, deep divisions, and of course he didn't want Lyndon Johnson on the ticket anymore, and he had to stabilize this the best he could. He wanted to get rid of Lyndon Johnson. He wanted to get rid of J. Edgar Hoover, and he wanted everything to resolve in 64. There was going to be major changes in 64. So this is a part of the reason why that, you know, everything culminated at one point, and they were looking at a 9-day countdown or a 10-day countdown when he hit Texas. Of course, Evelyn Lincoln, his secretary, her husband had overheard in a conversation of the Secret Service agents and Johnson's detail that he was going to be shot at in Texas. President Kennedy was aware of this. I mean, she had told him not to go, and he said, well, I'm aware of this. I'm aware of the possibility of a false flag. Or he had told Jackie Kennedy to wear that pink dress and to stay as far on the other side of the limousine as possible from him. It backfired on him, and I don't know whether he believed he would actually be assassinated or whether it would just be a false flag shooting at him, but either way, he lost his life, and of course that was very tragic.
One simple question. Joe Banana was the one who influenced Kennedy to have LBJ on the ticket. Okay, that's what they said for support of Chicago. And if you read the book, The Hoffa Wars, it shows that Joe Banana was broke off from the Northern Mafia, and he had three underbosses, Sam Giancana, Carlos Marcellus, and Santos Trafficante. What is the role of Joe Bonanno, both in the election of Kennedy and in the assassination of Kennedy?
Well, I can tell you what I've read, and that is that Lyndon Johnson was brought on a ticket as a whim for John F. Kennedy, but at the same time, it was very serious to J. Edgar Hoover and to Johnson. Now, Johnson assumed that Kennedy wouldn't live past 62. He had Addison's disease, which was pretty bad, and he had two doctors trying to keep him alive. But the fact is that Lyndon Johnson was brought on board to protect the interests of two things. One was the organized crime in the United States to protect their interests, and the other thing was the huge military contracts that were being directed through Texas. So, and of course, Lyndon Johnson was very instrumental in that. So was John Conway. So the Bobby Kennedy had taken upon himself to really go hard on the mafia side of these things to counterbalance Johnson's position on this. But I, as far as the specific individuals in the mafia, I couldn't address that specifically. I do know that they did influence some of the votes, and maybe in Chicago as well. But I don't have that much specific on that.
I can give one comment on that. General Dynamics. Basically, Bobby Baker was involved with some of the companies that involved in the General Dynamics. It was run by Henry Crown, who was directly tied to Capone. Now it's run by his son, Lester Crown. And he also ran the Aspen Institute. I don't know if you know anything about those guys.
Well, I mean, it's all about money, isn't it? And money and power. And these, and of course, Vietnam, the plan of war out of the Pentagon, gave these men a lot of power and a lot more money. And President Kennedy wanted nothing to do with that. Johnson was trying to drag him into this, and then he could definitely try to separate themselves from this.
Gentlemen, we're going to go to a break. We will be right back. Welcome back. This is Tiana. Our guest is Christopher Fulton, and his website is cmfulton.com. com, and he is the author, along with Michelle, his wife, of The Inheritance, Poison Fruit of JFK's Assassination. And a lot of things occurred because of that assassination. The war was, the war in Vietnam was accelerated, all kinds of other things. Is Art still there?
Yes.
Did you have another question?
Yes. This is related to Frank Wisner. For instance, his son, Frank Wisner Jr., who works for Patton and Boggs, a law firm up in New York City, he was the ambassador to India, worked closely and set up the U.S. India Business Council. The next guy took over was none other than a convicted felon, Rajat Gupta, who was the head of McKinsey Consulting. So the CIA played a major role in this whole H-1B visa program to import all this immigration labor. So I see it as a consequence of what Frank Wisner did and related to the JFK assassination. What is your insight on what Wisner was all about?
You have maybe more specific information on certain individuals than I can only direct what I've seen through the material that came out of the Kennedy White House, and then what Robert Kennedy was dealing with. And of course, he was really majorly concerned with this a domestic coup, or was this another situation so that he could resolve the issues with Russia? But the I can only say this, that the policies of everything was going to be redirected, and then of course as the assassination took place, and then Bobby Kennedy didn't make it in. All of these directives that were coming has only gotten worse and more progressive. So we've gone further and further down the road of things, in my opinion, that are bad for the American public. And I can only agree with you on that fact, that the agendas have gotten way out of hand and way farther down the road than they ever should have been.
Right. So last comment. Related to what I just said there, McKinsey Consulting. We had the Enron scandal with Jeff Skilling came from there. We had the Goldman Sachs mortgage security scandal come from there. We had Beth Corbett, who worked as a director for McKinsey for 30 years, worked for the Office of Budget Management. After we had the data spill at the Office of Personnel Management from the first manager, she took over. She was nothing but a front for the Clinton Foundation. And again, we had the big mess. And then also McKinsey Consulting's in Fannie Mae, which is one of the big mortgage providers in this country. And they're doing the same thing. They're wrecking it. So I can see how things evolved directly from the JFK assassination to today's events and the messes we're seeing.
Well, yeah. Absolutely. I can concur that the fact that, you know, I've seen things from when Mr. Gulland had orbited the Earth, that they had come up with a contingency that if he had died in that attempt, that they were gonna have information that said that that the Russians had planted something, the Cubans had planted something that caused that spacecraft to get destroyed, and then utilize that for purpose. So there's always a plan. There's always some thing that's been thought out and used for purpose. So yes, that's just got further and further out of control as this progresses.
Right. So as just to compliment on that, I see the Clinton Foundation was basically a direct consequence of the JFK assassination. If you look at the path of what Frank Wisner and what his son did, Frank Wisner Jr., and you look at her legacy, and we're at a website called No Place for Corruption that shows how things evolved in that situation as we're seeing it right now.
Well, Lyndon Johnson knew that Bobby Kennedy would not make it to the White House if he gained California, he would not make it there. He was aware of that. He had already okayed Nixon to go in because they had enough dirt on each other so that Nixon wouldn't out him as an illegal administration. So all of these concurring presidents of the United States after this have not been to the benefit, in my opinion, the benefit of the United States, the people of the United States.
Right. Now, with regard to that, remember what Johnson himself said in a conversation about the cover-up of the JFK assassination, talking to Hoover. He says, why don't you tell Robert F. Kennedy that we have some mutual associates through Hoffa?
Well, I mean, there was no love lost between Robert Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, and they hated each other with passion and would do anything they could to separate each other from and ruin each other if possible. But Johnson was forced to cooperate with Bobby because of his popularity after the assassination, and Robert Kennedy had to use that to his advantage, hoping to gain the White House in 68 and change the course. But, of course, that didn't happen.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Unfortunate. Thank you, Art. apparently, according to Mark in Florida, there was a party at Clint Murchison's home the evening of November 21st, 1963. I don't know.
That's very probable, and the fact remains that there was a change in Texas at the time that changed it from an off position to an on position. That could have occurred the night before or the morning of, but one way or the other, there were CIA team there to abort the false flag, and they were horrified when the president's head exploded. So the abort didn't take place, and then the full assassination took place.
Yikes. Alrighty, we are going to a quick 3-minute break. If you want to call in with a question, it's 800-313-9443. Be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Christopher Fulton. His website is cmfulton.com, where you can purchase his book. Unless you want a Kindle, then you know what to do, but I would recommend that you get it from Christopher. You and Art would have quite a lot to talk about, I think. The gentleman that just called in.
He seemed to know quite a bit about specific subjects, and I can only really comment or talk intelligently about what I had seen, so.
Right.
What's that?
Yes, what you're saying.
Yeah. What we were exposed to. So these are the things that I can comment on specifically. But people have a lot of the pieces of this from different aspects, and they're very interested in talking about that and then gaining the truth. And I commend them on that because nobody has all the information. We have a slice of this, and then other people have other pieces, and together as we all come together, and you can see a much more clear picture of our country and what the truth is about many subjects. And I think I commend any American citizen or anybody in the world who's interested in the truth and is interested in pursuing that. So I think that's very important too, as well.
Right. Now there were so many other things that occurred right after the. Within a couple of years after the assassination, and as you indicated, it was a very public demonstration of exactly what they, quote unquote, are willing to do in order to perpetrate their schemes and their objectives upon the American people. They are willing to publicly assassinate somebody, which of course is a very, very strong message to any president that followed Kennedy.
Well, it is, and when you're talking about the kind of wealth and the money that it was involved at that time, and of course it's even more now. But one man's life is it doesn't matter whether you're a sitting president or not. One man's life is certainly not of high consequence to that kind of power and that kind of influence in the world. And these morality issues of people of power, they grow up learning very quickly that they can affect the world by buying somebody off, whether it's $1 million or $10 million, it doesn't matter to them. And if they can't do it that way, they can either threaten you or ruin your life or whatever else they have to do just to gain their agenda. And there's very few people in the world that can stand up to that. So there's an understanding that there's them and us, or people that have worked their way up to gain power, Richard Nixon or these type of people. So once you get a taste of that, and once you've sold yourself out to those kind of people, whether you have skeletons in your closet or you've been blackmailed or you've sold yourself down the river for whatever else it is, you can, they usually rise you up through the ranks because you're very usable at that juncture because now they can pull your strings. So it's very difficult to get people of high morality in these positions, and President Kennedy was certainly an enigma. When he came in 1960, I don't think he would have thought that he would have changed his position so dramatically against his own government by 62 and 63. I don't believe that he would have switched gears that dramatically, but the important part of it is that he did, and we understand that he lost his life because of that, the betterment of the world, for the betterment of the people in the United States, and so did his brother. So that's the kind of thing that I keep in my heart, not to deify the individual specifically, but to say this is what they stood for, and they stood for it strong enough to lose their life, lay their life down for it. That's a lot of, that's as much love as you can ask from anybody.
Sure. What about the Federal Reserve? Was there anything in the information that you, the resources, the vast amount of resources that you were able to look at? Was there anything about the Federal Reserve?
A little bit. President Kennedy wanted to absolve us of that tremendous debt. And the problems that comes with that. So he had actually instructed I don't remember the exact number of $4 billion, maybe it was $4 million and the worth of notes, certificates of, to be issued, and then begin circulation. But of course after the assassination, they were brought back and destroyed immediately. But that would have, initiated the loss of power of the Federal Reserve System. And the changing of that, which the only other president that began touching on that subject was Abraham Lincoln, actually doing something about that. Of course, he was assassinated as well.
There are some caveats about that that are little known, but this is not time or place to talk about it. What about the Immigration Act of 1965, and which totally changed the demographics of our country thereafter?
Well, I didn't see anything. I don't remember anything specific to that. But if you look at it as an overall, and you look at it as a broad perspective rather than narrowing it down, you can see that there seems to be obviously there's agendas in place because the water is flowing this way and it's going strong. Longer, and it seems to have these purposes. If you're allowed to look at a policy of something and you say, well, this is working or this isn't working, let's divert this or change this or alter this, then you would see a pattern of changing and then the betterment of something and something working to its best potential. But all we're seeing is these policies leading down to more and more problems for the United States, and that's not beneficial in any way.
Right. And that the immigration, what was that, 1965, was passed in 1965, October 3rd, Immigration and Nationality Act, and it was railroaded into Congress by Edward M. Kennedy of Chappaquiddick fame. Which I find rather interesting.
It's interesting. I do too. Ted Kennedy has done several things which I think has not been beneficial. Now, I don't claim to know all the agreements that the Kennedy family is involved with or had to make, all the concessions they would have to make to retain the power or to continue forward. I know that I was only familiar with what had happened to Bobby Kennedy. But it seems to me that Ted Kennedy probably had to compromise on money areas, and of course he was involved in some things that I don't personally agree with, but at the same time JFK Jr. seemed to have a pretty good grasp on his father's policies and was interested in and maybe even restoring some of those ideas. Certainly didn't like the way that we were handling our foreign policies and all these false, wars and the abilities to magnify these weapons of destruction, out of control. But I believe that, he would have been somebody of great importance if he was allowed to have run and to affect change. I think people would have followed him and listened to him. But maybe he was taken out on a possible political level. But again, I shouldn't comment about any of that.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting. What about JFK's views of Israel having nuclear power?
Well, that's go ahead.
Was there anything in his records that you saw that would define his views on that?
Position on that? I think I'll defer on that question for now.
Okay. Okay. There were and what else happened after 1965? The tax structure changed. I think churches then became very they automatically got a tax break simply because they were churches. But I believe at that time they became corporations and were more compliant with government regulations about what they could and could not say in order to retain their tax status.
Well, President Kennedy thought that Americans should be free as much as possible, and was against the idea of too much regulation. Of course, it's gone more and more. We've got so many federal laws on the books that the average American person probably breaks several of them a day without knowing it. But there's just so many laws on the books that now that. And I've watched this process in person that you can come up with almost any kind of statute or any kind of a situation to ensnare somebody and hurt them if that's what your intent is to do. If the Justice Department decides that that's what they want to harm someone, it's not difficult to do that.
That is so sad.
Well, it is sad. It's sad that we call ourselves in this great nation and democracy that was established in 1776 as something different in the world and important and fought for that and the Constitution. With the Constitution, when I was in court, you couldn't bring a constitutional argument into federal court. If you brought a constitutional argument, they would warn you, and then if you continued on that vein, they would bar you, and you, as a lawyer in the federal system, being barred, you're finished. You can't practice in federal court, so I don't really understand. Well, I do understand, but I think it's extremely sad that our country has gone on to this extreme and this level that we've reached now down the wrong road, and it has not been corrected. I think the empowerment has to come from the consensus of the American public, the American citizens of this country. They have to take some interest. And how the world and this country is going to continue, and what's important to our humanity and what's important to our rights, and how we're going to deal with that. I certainly don't advocate a violent view, but I do advocate a view of strength and unity and purpose and fulfilling those obligations because that's what it takes to keep a democracy, and that's what it takes to fulfill your citizenship. At this time, we can't cruise any longer. If we continue to cruise without taking some stances, and we're going to lose, the whole ball of wax, and then, of course, you won't get that back.
Right. And we're supposed to actually be a republic based on a set of laws, and it's so ironic that American politicians are so arrogant that they decide that they're going to bomb another country into forming a democracy. Is that irony? Yeah, let's go bomb them so that we can make a democracy. Which that is what I guess that is what they what one of their ploys. But when you really look at it. You have to say, okay, what are they telling the American public? Or is the American public even listening? Because when you go to a baseball game or a football game or whatever else they're playing, I don't do any of that kind of stuff. But it's so militaristic. that they use sports and other things to militarize the American public into complying with an agenda to go and slaughter somebody. And even the games themselves, they incorporate militaristic terms. We're going to slaughter the other team. And don't they sing the national anthem at these things? Which I, bombs bursting in air. That is abhorrent to me.
Well, I would encourage someone to go back. I mean, you watch a show that was produced on television in 62 or 63, and you watch it, just as an example, and you watch a television program, and you see the morals involved in that. You see, of course, simplicity. Most people don't have the patience for that. But if you look at the way the values are constructed, the way that the America's betrayed, and the people that were doing these programs, and then you go after the assassination, and you watch, and you see how it degrades and where we're going. I mean, you look at a program like the Andy Griffith Show, for example. I mean, if you watch that, you can actually see the change in the program after the Kennedy assassination and how things changed. You go to All in the Family that was put in the 1970s, and how the separation and the arguments that took place of what was going on. And this is a progressive thing, and it's going further and further down the road, but we've lost so many sight of who we were, who we were supposed to be, and the core values of things, and our beliefs, and what the country was founded on, and why what's important, and these things that have to be done, in my personal opinion, either for purpose or maybe it's just a consensus of degrade that happens in a natural environment, but either way, it's a negative effect. And these wars that you talk about that take place, there's always some kind of a rallying around some kind of a reasoning for these type of things. But usually, it's a resources or oil or a national security concern, or showing our resolve to another country, maybe merely dropping some new weapon or showing the ability of a new weapon so that a country realizes we're far in advance of them and to keep their distance. Whatever the agenda may be, it's usually not what the propagandized idea is. And killing people in that regard for that purpose, I don't know what else to say other than it's evil. What else can you say?
Yes, there's not too many other things you can say. It is truly evil. We do have a caller, Ed in Utah. Ed?
Oh, yeah. Deanna?
Yes.
It's been a while.
It has.
How do you pronounce your last name, Chris? Is it Bolton?
Well, it's Fulton with an F, F-U-L-T-O-N.
Well, F, Fulton.
Fulton.
Yes, sir.
Yes, have I been not saying it correctly?
I appreciate it. Yeah.
Yes.
There's just a few things I want to throw at you. I want to get one very minor thing out of the way first. And maybe either one of you could, on the JFK, the main topic here. You know, when I was young, I was around. And I remember, Deanna and Chris, when it was reported on all the networks, it was Bud Oswald a lot of the time, Bud Oswald. And then later, of course, you know, and at the time a bit, back and forth, Lee Harvey. Is there any significance to that, either one of you?
Okay.
I want to get that.
We're going to a quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back and stay on, and Chris will answer it. Be right back. We are back, and our guest today is a wonderful gentleman who has written a wonderful book with his wife, Christopher Fulton. Fulton, F-U-L-T-O-N. The website is cmfulton.com. And you were talking about how things have changed. You have to bring up the women's movement in the 60s, abortion. Just the whole morality of the country has definitely changed.
Well, yeah, I think it was Ed that was asking me a question. Is that correct? Is he still on?
Yes. Yeah,
I wanted to answer that. The Lee Harvey Oswald was an intelligence officer, was an informant for the FBI, and so he'd been utilized in different intelligence operations, involved even in some bio weapons stuff, and basically he had several identifications that were issued to him, government IDs, and so when this assassination took place, and it wasn't just a false flag attempt, but it was a full assassination, Lee Harvey Oswald went into kind of a panic mode, but not so much panic. He was well-trained. He wanted to make a difference in the world. He was a very gung-ho Marine. But the names that might have come out at the time, it's hard to tell for what purpose, but the original idea was to get him close to Castro, that he was a person of interest and sympathy towards Castro and his regime, and that some of the stuff that was planted in his file by the intelligence community in his FBI file is actually false, and it was his dissonant ideas and all this type of thing was there to get in close to Castro to help assassinate Castro. So when they were coming out with a name, that could have been part of what they were doing to the plan of this whole thing, if it had been a false flag or not. But he had several different identifications utilizing different names.
Okay, that kind of helps clear it up a bit. Just quickly, I'll get into the meat of why I called. I'm like a few of the other people out here in the RBN audience, Chris. I read, as has Deanna Spangola, Final Judgment by Michael Collins Piper, and I do view it as the last word. But there were people involved, people like you, in the eye of the storm, in the aftermath and what have you of this, Chris, that can, as Piper himself put it, as Michael Piper put it, when he wrote the book, he said, I hope many others come after me that can flesh out this basic story. And yes, it does have to do with the nuclear program at the Dimona Desert in Israel. And yes, Mark Lane did the groundbreaking book, who's a friend of Michael Piper. Both were cited at the American Free Press newspaper, which I'm sure you're familiar with. I didn't hear it brought up yet today. But would you have...
Ed, we are running out of time.
Oh, okay.
I want to give Chris the last word here. So thank you for your call, but we're running out of time. We're out of time.
All right. I'm sure that was leading somewhere, but I didn't get to see him conclude. So.
Yeah. Well, I think what he was saying was that yes, you did come up with some more information that adds so much to what we didn't know. And I thank you for writing this book, and thank your wife for writing this book, and thank you for all that you're doing and all that you've suffered because of what you did. Just trying to alert people.
So well,
thank you for doing
thank you
that.
For having me on, Deanna. I appreciate you and appreciate your time. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and you've written a fabulous book, and I hope people will buy it at your website, right? And that website, again, is cmfulton.com. Okay, Christopher, thank you so much.
Have a very nice day. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye, listeners. Bye-bye. Chat with you next week.